alcohol, fumes pouring from his body in nearly radiant waves. He had blood pressure high enough to make his flushed face glow, and his pug nose had a ruby cast that gave him the kindly look of a Kmart Santa Claus. He was shorter than I, and therefore didn't seem that threatening. In fact, he had a puzzled air about him that made me want to reach out and pat him on the head. I realized I'd seen the guy twice in my constant cruising of the hotel in search of Wendell and his lady friend. Both times I'd spotted him in the bar. Once alone, his elbow propped up, his cigarette ember weaving as he orchestrated his own lengthy monologue. Once in a party of bawdy guys his age, overweight, out of shape, smoking cigars, and telling the kinds of jokes that inspired sudden martini-generated guffaws. I had a decision to make. I slowed myself to a leisurely pace. I reached over and lifted his glasses gingerly from his face, folding the stem so I could tuck them into my shirt pocket. "Hey, stud, how are you? You're looking good tonight." His hands came up in a helpless gesture of protest. I unbuttoned my right sleeve while I gave him a look of lingering assessment.
"Who are you?" he asked.
I smiled, blinking lazily as I unbuttoned my left sleeve.
"Surprise, surprise! Where you been all this time? I've been looking for you since 6 o'clock tonight."
"Do I know you?"
"Well, I'm sure you will, Jack. We're going to have us a good old time tonight."
He shook his head.
"I think you've made a mistake. My name's not Jack."
"I call everybody Jack," I said, as I unbuttoned my blouse.
I let the flaps hang open, revealing tantalizing glimpses of my maidenly flesh. Happily, I was wearing the one bra not held together with safety pins. In that light, how could he tell if it was faintly gray from the wash?
"Can I have my glasses? I don't see very well without them."
"You don't? Well, now that's too bad. What's the deal here? You nearsighted, farsighted, astigmatism, what?"
"Stigmatism," he said apologetically. "I'm kind of nearsighted, too, and this one eye is lazy."
As if to demonstrate, the gaze in his one eye drifted outward, following the flight path of an unseen bug.
"Well, don't you worry none. I'll stay real close so you can see me good. You ready to party?"
"Party?"
The one eye drifted back.
"The boys sent me up. Those fellas you hang out with said today's your birthday and everybody pitched in to buy you a present."
"I'm it." "You're a Cancer, is that right?" His frown was slow and his smile flickered on and off. He couldn't quite comprehend what was happening, but he didn't want to be unkind. He also didn't want to make a fool of himself just in case this was a joke.
"It's not my birthday today."
Lights were being flipped on in the room next door, and I could hear the woman's voice rise in anger and distress.
"Now it is," I said.
I pulled out my shirt tail and peeled my blouse off like a stripper. He hadn't taken a puff of his cigarette since I arrived. I took the lighted cigarette from his hand and tossed it over the railing, and then I moved closer, squeezing his mouth into a pout like I intended to kiss him.
"You got something better to do?"
He laughed uneasily.
"I guess not," he said in a little puff of cigarette breath. "Yum, yum."
I kissed him right on the puss, using some slurpy lip and tongue stuff I'd seen in the movies. It didn't seem any sexier when other people did it. I took his hand and drew him into his hotel room, trailing my blouse along the floor like a feather boa. As Wendell came out onto his balcony, I was in the process of closing the sliding glass door behind us.
"Why don't you relax while I clean myself up? Then I can bring a little soap and warm water and we'll clean you up too. Would you like that?"
"You mean just lie down like this?"
"You always make whoopee with your shoes on, 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 with your honey bun? Why don't you take them old Bermuda shorts off while you're at it?
I have to take care of a little something in the other room, and then I'll be right out.
I want you ready now, you hear? Then I'll blow out that big old candle of yours."
The guy was unlacing one sturdy black business shoe, which he pulled off and tossed, peeling off a black nylon sock in haste. He looked like somebody's nice, short, fat granddaddy. Also like a 5-year-old prepared to cooperate if there was a cookie in the offing. I could hear Renata in the next room begin to shriek. Then Wendell's voice thundered, his words indistinguishable. I gave my friend a little finger wave. "Be right back," I sang. I sashayed toward the bathroom where I set his eyeglasses by the basin, then leaned over and turned on the faucet. Cold water gushed out with a vigorous splashing that masked all other sounds. I shrugged into my blouse, eased over to the door, and went out into the hall, closing the door behind me with care. My heart was thudding, and I felt the cold air in the corridor wash across my bare skin. I moved swiftly to my room, pulled my key out of my pants pocket and jammed it in the keyhole, turned it, opened the door, and shut it behind me. I slid the burglar chain into place and stood there for a moment, my back to the door, pulse racing while I rebuttoned my blouse as quickly as I could. I felt an involuntary shiver run down my frame from head to toe. I don't know how hookers do it. Yuck! I crossed to the balcony and closed my sliding glass door, which I locked with a snap. I pulled the drapes, and then I moved back to the door and looked out through the spy hole. The old drunk was now standing halfway out in the hallway. Mr. Magoo-like, he peered right, squinting without his glasses. He was still in his shorts, one sock off and one sock on. He'd begun to eye my door with interest. Suddenly, I wondered if the man was as drunk as he'd first appeared. He glanced around casually, making sure he couldn't be observed, and then he moved over to my fisheye and tried to peer in. I pulled back instinctively and held my breath. I knew he couldn't see me. From his side, it must have been like looking down the wrong end of a telescope. He gave a shy little knock.
"Miss, you in there?"
He placed his eye against the spy hole again, blocking the little circle of light from the hallway. I swear I could smell his breath through the wood. I saw light in the fisheye again, and I approached with care, pressing my eye to the tiny eye to the tiny eye to the tiny eye to the tiny eye to the circle so I could peer out at him. He had backed up and was looking down the hall again with uncertainty. He moved to my left, and after a moment I heard his door close with a thunk. I tiptoed over to the sliding glass and took a position just to the left, my back against the wall, as I peered out. Suddenly, slyly, the top portion of the old guy's head appeared as he craned around the wall between his balcony and mine, trying to get a glimpse into my darkened room.
"Ooh-hoo," he whispered hoarsely. "It's me. Is it time to party yet?"
This guy's blood was up. It wouldn't be long before he'd paw the ground and snort. I held myself motionless and waited him out. After a moment, he withdrew. 10 seconds later, my telephone rang, a room-to-room call, if you really want my guess. I let it ring endlessly while I felt my way into the bathroom and brushed my teeth in the dark. I fumbled back toward the bed, peeled my clothes off, and laid them on the chair. I didn't dare leave my room. I couldn't read because I didn't want to risk turning on the light. In the meantime, I was so wired I thought my hair might be standing straight up on end. I finally tiptoed to the minibar and extracted 2 small bottles of gin and some orange juice. I sat up in bed and sipped screwdrivers until I felt myself getting sleepy. When I emerged in the morning, the drunk's door was shut with a Do Not Disturb tag hung over the knob.
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
When I emerged in the morning, the drunk's door was shut with a Do Not Disturb tag hung over the knob. Wendell's door was standing open, and the room was empty. The same cart was parked in the corridor between rooms. I peered in and caught sight of the same maid, patiently damp-mopping the tile floor. She set the mop aside, leaning it against the wall near the bathroom while she picked up the wastebasket and carried it into the hall. "¿Dónde están?" I said, hoping that I was saying, "Where are they?" She must have known better than to pepper her response with lots of past participles and pluperfects. I wasn't going to get it unless she kept the meaning down to a minimum. What I believe she said was,
Gone, they leave, not here.
Permanente?
Completely vamos?
Sí, sí.
She nodded vigorously and repeated her original statement. Mind if I take a look? I didn't really wait for her permission. I pushed my way into room 312, where I checked the dresser drawers, the night table, the desk, the mini bar. God damn it! They hadn't left me anything. Meanwhile, the maid was watching me with interest. She shrugged to herself and moved back into the bathroom, where she tucked the wastebasket under the sink again. Gracias, I said to her, and backed out of the room. As I passed the cleaning cart, I caught sight of the plastic bag attached to one end, filled with newly accumulated trash. I snagged it off the hook and carried it back to my room, closing the door behind me. I moved over to the bed and dumped the contents on the spread. There was nothing of interest. Yesterday's papers, Q-tips, used tissues, an empty can of hairspray. I picked through with distaste, hoping my tetanus shots were up to date. As I gathered the detritus and stuffed it all back in the bag, I caught sight of the front page, which was splashed with news of a crime spree. I unfolded the section, flattened the newsprint, and studied the Spanish. Living in Santa Teresa, I've learned it's almost impossible not to pick up a smattering of the language, whether you take a Spanish class or not. Many words have been borrowed, and many simply mirror their counterparts in English. Sentence construction is fairly straightforward, and pronunciation is consistent. The story that was spread across page one of La Gaceta had something to do with a homicide, homicidio, in the Estados Unidos. I read aloud to myself in the halting style of a kindergartner, which helped me decipher some of the meaning of the text. A woman had been murdered, her body found on a deserted stretch of highway just north of Los Angeles. Four male inmates had escaped from the juvenile facility in Perdido County, California, fleeing south along the coast. Apparently, they'd flagged down the victim and commandeered her car, shooting her in the process. By the time the body was discovered, the escapees had reached the Mexican border, crossing into Mexicali, where they'd killed again. The federales had caught up with them, and in a wild exchange of gunfire, two youths were killed and another was severely wounded. Even in black and white, the photograph of the shooting scene seemed unnecessarily lurid, with ominous dark splotches on the shrouded bodies of the deceased. The four juveniles were pictured in a row of sullen mugshots. Three were Hispanic. The fourth was identified as a kid named Brian Jaffe. I booked the first flight back. On the plane coming home, my sinuses seized up, and during our descent into Los Angeles, I thought my eardrums would burst. I arrived in Santa Teresa at 9 o'clock, bearing with me all the symptoms of an old-fashioned cold. My throat was scratchy, my head ached, and my nasal passages stung like I'd sucked a pint of salt water up my nose. I couldn't help but rejoice, anticipating the use of NyQuil in fully authorized nightly doses. Once safely home, I locked the door behind me and hauled a stack of newspapers up my spiral stairs. I emptied my duffel into the dirty clothes hamper, stripped off my travel clothes, and added them to the mix. I donned my sweat socks and flannel nightie and tucked myself into the hand-stitched quilt Henry's sister made for my birthday, settling in with the accounts of the jailbreak in the Santa Teresa paper. The story had already been moved to the second section, page 3. I got to read it all again, only this time in English. Wendell Jaffe's younger son, Brian, along with three Confederates, had made a daring daylight escape from the medium-security juvenile commitment facility called Conet. The dead inmates were identified as Julio Rodriguez, 16, and Ernesto Padilla, whose age was 15. I wasn't sure what extradition agreements the United States had with Mexico, but it looked like Brian Jaffe was being sent back to the States as soon as sheriff's deputies could be dispatched. The fourth escapee, a 14-year-old, was still in critical condition in a hospital in Mexico. His name was being withheld from the local papers because of his age. The Spanish-language paper, as I recollected, had listed him as Ricardo Guevara. Both the murder victims had been Americans, and it was possible the federales were anxious to relinquish responsibility. It was also possible that a great whack of cash had been passed under the table. Whatever the circumstances, the escapees were lucky not to find themselves permanently incarcerated down there.
According to the paper, Brian Jaffe had celebrated his 18th birthday shortly after his capture, which meant that once he was returned to the Perdido County Jail, he'd be kept and charged as an adult. I found a pair of scissors and clipped all the articles, setting them aside to take with me for the office files. I glanced at the clock on my bedside table. It was only 9:45. I picked up the phone and called Mac Voorhees at home. Chapter 5. "Hi, it's Kinsey," I said when Mac picked up on his end.
"You don't sound like yourself. Where are you calling from?"
"Here in town," I said. "I just came down with a cold and I'm feeling like death."
"That's too bad. Welcome home. I wasn't sure when to expect you back."
"I walked in the door 45 minutes ago," I said. "I've been reading the papers and I see you had some excitement while I was gone."
"Can you believe it? I don't know what the hell is going on. I haven't heard a word about this family for the last 2-3 years. Now all of a sudden the name's cropping up everywhere."
"Yeah, well, here it comes again. We hit pay dirt on Wendell. I spotted him right where Dick Mills said he'd be."
"Are you sure it's him?"
"Of course I'm not sure, Mac. I never laid eyes on the man before, but judging from the photographs, this fellow comes damn close. For one thing, he's American, and he's in the right age group. He's not using the name Jaffe. It's Dean DeWitt Huff. But the height's on the money, and the weight seemed close enough. He's somewhat heavier, but he probably would be in any event. He's traveling with a woman, and the two kept themselves very isolated."
"Sounds pretty sketchy."
"Of course it's sketchy. I could hardly walk up to him and introduce myself."
"How sure are you on a scale of 1 to 10?
"Let's put it this way. Adjusting for age and some surgical tampering, I'd say a 9. I tried to get some pictures, but he was very paranoid about attention. I had to maintain a very low profile," I said. "By the way, what was Brian Jaffe in jail for, has anybody said?"
"As I understand it, some kind of burglary. Probably nothing sophisticated, or he wouldn't have been caught," Mac said. "What about Wendell? Where is he at this point?"
"That's a very good question."
"He got away," Mac said flatly.
"More or less. He and the woman took off in the dead of night, but don't start screaming yet. You want to know what I found? This was in their room after they checked out. A Mexican newspaper featuring Brian Jaffe's capture. Wendell must have spotted it in the late edition because the two of them went off to dinner at the regular time. Next thing I know, they're hightailing it back and they're both upset. By this morning, they were gone. I found the newspaper in the trash." Even as I played out my recital of the facts, I realized something about the situation was bothering me. It was too coincidental. Wendell Jaffe ensconced in that obscure Mexican resort, Brian breaking out of jail and heading straight for the border. I could feel a spark of insight connect the two events.
"Oh, wait a minute, Mac. I got a little flash here. Catch this. You know what just occurred to me?"
From the moment I spotted Wendell, he was skimming through the papers, 5 or 6 altogether, and he was checking every page. What if he knew Brian would be making that escape? He could have been waiting for him. It's possible Wendell even helped set it up.
Mac cleared his throat with a skeptical hum. "That's pretty far-fetched. Let's don't jump to conclusions until we know what's what."
"Yeah, I know, you're right, but it adds up in a way. I'll table it for now, but I may check it out later."
"Any idea where Jaffe went?"
I talked to the desk clerk in my rudimentary Spanish, but it didn't produce much except a half-concealed smirk. "If you want my opinion, I think there's a good chance he's heading back in this direction." I could practically hear Max squinting through the telephone lines.
"I don't believe it. You really think he'd step a foot in this state? He wouldn't have the nerve. The man would have to be nuts."
"I know it sounds risky, but his kid's in trouble. Put yourself in his place. Wouldn't you do the same?"
There was silence. Max's kids were grown, but I knew he was still protective. "How could he have known what was going on?"
"I don't know, Mac. It's always possible he kept in touch. We don't have a clue where he's been all these years. Maybe he still has contacts in the area. It's probably worth pursuing if we're trying to get a line on his current whereabouts."
Mac cut in. "What's the game plan here? You have a scheme in the works?"
"Well, I think we should find out how soon the kid's being brought back from Mexicali. I can't believe much will happen over the weekend. Monday I can talk with one of the deputies at the county jail. Maybe we can pick up Wendell's trail from there.
Sounds like a long shot.
The long shot was Dick Mills spotting him in the first place.
True enough,
he conceded, though he wasn't happy about it. I've also been thinking we should talk to the local cops. They have the kind of resources I can't touch.
I could hear him hesitate. Seems early to bring the police into it, but I'll let you use your own judgment. I wouldn't mind the help, but I'd hate to scare him off. If he shows, that is.
I'm going to have to get in touch with some old friends of his.
We'll just have to run the risk of somebody warning him off. You think his pals will cooperate?
I have no idea. I gather he ripped off a lot of folks back then. Surely there are some who'd like to see him land in jail.
You'd think so, he said.
Anyway, we'll talk Monday morning, and in the meantime, don't fret. Mac's laugh was bleak.
Let's hope Gordon Titus doesn't get wind of this.
I thought you said you'd take care of him.
I was picturing an arrest. Lots of public glory for you.
Hold on to the thought. We may get there yet. I spent the next 2 days in bed, my vacation extending into a lazy, unproductive weekend by virtue of my affliction. I loved the solitude of illness, the luxury of hot tea with honey, the canned tomato soup with gooey grilled cheese sandwiches. I kept a box of Kleenex on my nightstand, and the wastebasket by the bed was soon filled to the rim with a puffy souffle of used tissues. One of the few concrete memories I have of my mother was her salving my chest with Vicks VapoRub, then covering it with a square of pink rose-sprigged flannel, secured to my pajama top with safety pins. The heat of my body would envelop my nasal passages in a cloud of heady fumes, while the ointment on my skin conveyed a mentholated contradiction of searing heat and biting cold. I dozed fitfully during the day, my body aching with inactivity. For 2 hours each afternoon I staggered down my spiral stairs, dragging my quilt behind me like a wedding train. I curled up on my sofa bed and flipped on the television set, watching mindless reruns of Dobie Gillis and I Love Lucy. At bedtime I stood in my bathroom at the sink and filled my little plastic cup with the vile dark green syrup that would ensure a good night's sleep. I've never once downed a hit of NyQuil without shuddering violently afterward. Nonetheless, I'm aware that I harbor all the incipient characteristics of an over-the-counter cold medication addict. Monday morning I woke at 6 a.m., only moments before the alarm was set to go off. Once I opened my eyes, I lay in my rumpled nest and stared up at the domed plexiglass skylight above my bed, trying to gauge the day ahead. The morning sky was thickly overcast, bright white clouds forming a dense ceiling probably half a mile thick. At the airport, the commuter flights to San Francisco, San Jose, and Los Angeles would be stalled out on the runways, waiting for the fog to lift. July in Santa Teresa is an unsettling affair. Morning dawns behind a cloud bank that lingers just off the coast. Sometimes the marine layer clears by afternoon. Other times the sky remains overcast and the day stretches on in a nebulous gloom, creating the illusion of storm clouds hovering. The local citizens complain, and the Santa Teresa dispatch reports the temperatures in a chiding tone, as if the summer season weren't always this way. Tourists who arrive in search of rumored California sunshine spread their paraphernalia on the beach, umbrellas and sunscreen, portable radios and swim fins, waiting patiently for a break in the monotonous gray skies. I see their little children hunkered in the surf with toy buckets and shovels. Even from a distance, I can sense their goosebumps and pale blue lips, teeth beginning to chatter as the icy water surges around their bare feet. This year, the weather had been very strange, varying wildly from one day to the next. I rolled out of bed, pulled on my sweats, brushed my teeth, and combed my hair, avoiding the sight of my sleep-smudged face. I was determined to run, but my body thought otherwise, and after half a mile I was beset by a coughing fit that sounded like the mating call of some wild beast. I abandoned the notion of a 3-mile jog and contented myself with a brisk walk instead. My cold, by then, had settled in my chest, and my voice had dropped into that wonderful husky FM disc jockey range. By the time I reached home, I was chilled but invigorated. I took a steaming hot shower to loosen my bronchial passages and emerged from the bathroom feeling somewhat restored. I changed my sheets, emptied trash, ate a breakfast of fruit and yogurt, and went into the office with a file folder full of clippings. I found a parking space down the street, hoofed a block and a half, then hit the stairs. My usual pace is 2 stairs at a time, but today I had to pause at every landing on the way up. The downside of fitness, which takes years to achieve, is how quickly it vanishes, almost instantly. After 3 days of inactivity, I was back to square one, huffing and puffing like a rank amateur. The shortness of breath inspired a renewed round of coughs. I entered through the side door and paused to blow my nose. As I passed Ida Ruth's desk, I stopped for a chat. When I first met Lonnie's secretary, I found the double name unwieldy. I tried shortening it to Ida, but I found it didn't suit. The woman is in her mid-30s, a robust outdoor type who looks as if a day of typing would drive her round the bend. Her hair is white blonde, combed away from her face as if blown by a strong wind. Her complexion is sun-scrubbed, her lashes white, her eyes an ocean blue. Her clothing is conservative, straight, medium-length skirts, boxy jackets in muted tones. Her blouse is a boring succession of the long-sleeved button-down sort. She looks like she'd prefer to be paddling a kayak or climbing the face of a rock in some national park. I've heard that in her spare time she does precisely that. Backpacking trips to the High Sierras, 15-mile day hikes in the local mountain range. She's undeterred by ticks, steep inclines, venomous snakes, poison oak, sticks, sharp rocks, mosquitoes, or any of the other joyous aspects of nature I avoid at all costs. She flashed a smile when she saw me. "You're back. How is Mexico? You turned orange, I see." I was in the process of blowing my nose, my cheeks suffused with pink from the climb to the third floor. "Great. I had a ball. Picked up a cold on the plane coming back. I've been in bed for 2 days." "That's my faux tan," I said. She opened her pencil drawer and took out a mint dish filled with big white pills. "Vitamin C. Take a handful. It'll help." Dutifully, I plucked up a pill which I held to the light. It was easily an inch long and looked like it would require surgical removal if it got lodged going down. "Go on, help yourself, and try zinc if your throat hurts. How is Viento Negro? Did you get up to see the ruins?" I picked up another couple of vitamin C's.
"Pretty good, a little windy. What ruins?"
"You're kidding. The ruins are famous. There was a huge volcano that blew... Oh, I don't know. In 1902? It was something like that. In a matter of hours, the entire town was buried in a blanket of ash."
"I saw the ash," I said helpfully.
Her telephone rang, and she took the call while I continued across the hall, pausing at the water cooler to fill a paper cup. I tossed down the vitamin C, adding an antihistamine for good measure. Better living through chemistry. I moved on to my office, unlocked the door, and opened one of the windows, letting in some fresh air after the week away. There was a pile of mail on my desk, a few checks for accounts receivable, and the rest of it junk. I checked my answering machine for messages. There were six, and I spent the next 30 minutes getting life in order. I made up a file for Wendell Jaffe and tucked in the newspaper articles about his son's escape and recapture. At 9 o'clock, I put a call through to the Santa Teresa Police Department. I asked for Sergeant Robb, belatedly aware that my heart had begun to thump. I hadn't seen Jonah for a year by my calculations. I'm not sure our relationship could ever have been classified as an affair. At the time I first met him, he was separated from his wife, Camilla. She'd walked out on the marriage, taking both their daughters, leaving Jonah with a freezer full of home-cooked meals that she'd placed in recycled TV dinner trays. In roughly 300 foil-wrapped tins, she'd assembled an entree and two vegetables. The directions, taped to the top, always said the same thing. Bake in 350 oven for 30 minutes, remove foil and eat. Like he was really going to try to eat with the foil in place. Jonah didn't seem to think that was weird, which should have been a clue. In theory, he was a free man. In truth, she kept him on a tight rein. She'd come back at intervals, insisting that the two of them see a therapist. She'd find a new marriage counselor for each reconciliation, thus assuring that no real progress was ever made. If they came anywhere close to working out a relationship, she would split again. I finally decided that I had troubles enough, so I removed myself from the situation. Not that either of them seemed to notice. They'd been together since the 7th grade, when both were 13 years old. One day I would read about them in the local paper, celebrating the wedding anniversary where etiquette suggests gifts made of recycled aluminum. In the meantime, Jonah was still working the missing persons detail. He came on the line abruptly, using his businesslike policeman's manner. "Lieutenant Robb," he said.
Oh, wow, it's Lieutenant Rob. You've been promoted. Congratulations. This is a voice from your past. It's Kinsey Milhone, I said.
I enjoyed the moment of startled silence while he computed my identity. I pictured him suddenly sitting back in his chair.
Well, hey there. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not bad. You have a cold? I didn't recognize your voice. You sound all stuffed up.
We went through the formalities, exchanging basic information, which didn't take that long. I told him I'd left California Fidelity. He told me Camilla had come back to him. I could see it wasn't any different from missing 15 episodes of your favorite soap opera. Tuning in again weeks later, you realize you really haven't lost a beat. Like a plot synopsis, Jonah began to fill me in.
Yeah, she got a job last month, working as a court clerk. I think she's happier. She has a little money of her own, and everybody seems to like her. She thinks it's interesting, you know what I mean? Helps her understand my job, which is good for both of us.
Well, that's great. It sounds good, I said. He must have noticed I didn't press for additional details. I could feel the conversation stalling like a biplane about to crash. It's disconcerting to realize how little you have to say to someone who once occupied such a prominent place in your bed.
You're probably wondering why I got in touch, I said.
Jonah laughed.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I'm glad to hear from you, but I figured there was something up.
Remember Wendell Jaffe, the guy who disappeared off his sailboat?
Oh, yeah, of course.
He's been spotted in Mexico. It's possible he's on his way back to California.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. I told him an abbreviated version of my encounter with Wendell, omitting the fact that I'd broken into his room. In talking to cops, I don't always volunteer information. I can be a dutiful citizen when it suits my purposes, but this wasn't one of those occasions. For starters, I was secretly embarrassed that I'd blown the contact. If I'd done the job right, Wendell never would have known anyone was on his tail. I said, "Who should I be talking to? I thought I ought to notify someone, preferably the detective in charge of the case back then."
"That'd be Lieutenant Brown, but he's gone now. He retired last year. You'll probably want to talk to Lieutenant Whiteside and Major Frauds. I can have you transferred if you like. That Jaffe was a badass. Neighbor of mine lost 10 grand because of him, and that was peanuts compared to most."
I gathered as much. Did they have any recourse?
They put his partner in jail. Once the scam came to light, all the investors brought suit. Since there wasn't any way to get Jaffe served, they ended up publishing the summons and complaint and finally took his default. Of course, they got the judgment, but there wasn't any way to collect from him. He stripped all his bank accounts before he disappeared.
So I heard. What a bummer.
You got that right. Plus, he was mortgaged to the eyeballs, so his house wasn't worth a cent. I know people who'd love to think he's still around someplace. He ever showed up, they'd enforce the judgment in 10 seconds flat, whip his ass into court and take everything he had. Then he'd be arrested.
What makes you think he'd be dumb enough to come back?
He's got a kid in big trouble, according to the papers. You know those four inmates who escaped from Connacht? One of them was Brian Jaffe.
Shit, that's right. I didn't make the connection. I knew Dana in high school.
That's his wife? I asked. That's right. Her maiden name was Annenberg. She got married right after graduation.
Can you get me an address?
Shouldn't be too hard. She's probably in the book. Last I heard, she was down around P.O. someplace.
P.O. was the ready reference locally to the two adjoining towns, Perdido and Olvidado, on Highway 101, 30 miles to the south. The towns looked just the same, except that one favored shrubs along the highway and the other did not. Usually the two were referred to in the same breath. P.O., with a hash mark mentally inserted between the initials. I was making notes like crazy on a legal pad. Jonah's tone underwent a shift.
I've missed you.
I ignored that, conjuring up a piece of fiction to extricate myself before the conversation turned personal.
Oops, I better go. I have a client due in 10 minutes, and I want to talk to Lieutenant Whiteside first. Can you have me switched over to his extension?
Sure thing, he said. I heard him depress the plunger rapidly several times in succession. When the operator picked up, he had the call transferred to the detective bureau. Lieutenant Whiteside was away from his desk, but was expected back shortly. I left my name and number with a request to have him get back to me. Chapter 6. At noon, feeling punk, I walked up to the corner mini-market where I bought a tuna salad sandwich, a bag of potato chips, and a Diet Pepsi. I figured this was no time to obsess about being nutritionally correct. I went back to my office and ate sitting at my desk. For dessert, I sucked on some cherry cough drops. Lieutenant Whiteside finally called me at 2:35 with apologies for the delay.
Lieutenant Robb tells me you may have a line on our old friend Wendell Jaffe. What's the story?
For the second time that day, I went through an abbreviated version of my encounter. From the nature of the silence on his end, I had to guess Lieutenant Whiteside was taking notes. He said,
"You have any idea if he's using an alias?"
"If you don't press for details, I'll confess I did get a wee tiny glimpse at his passport, which was issued in the name Dean DeWitt Huff. He's traveling in the company of a woman named Renata Huff, who must be his common-law wife."
"Why common-law?"
"He's not divorced, as far as I've heard. His first wife had him declared dead a couple of months ago." "Oh, wait a minute now. Can dead men remarry? I hadn't thought about that. It's possible he isn't really a bigamist. Anyway, according to the data I saw, the passports came out of Los Angeles. He may well be in the country now. Is there any way to track the names through the passport office down there?"
Lieutenant Whiteside eased in. "Not a bad idea. Spell the last name for me, if you would. Is it H-O-U-G-H?
H-U-F-F.
I'm making myself a memo," he said. "What I'll do is check with Los Angeles and see what passport records show. We can always notify customs officials at LAX and San Diego so they can keep an eye out in case he comes through either port of entry. I can also notify San Francisco just to cover that base.
You want the passport numbers?"
"Might as well, though my guess is the passports are forged or counterfeit. If he skipped, which is what it looks like, Jaffe may have ID in half a dozen names. He's been gone a long time, and he may have set up more than one set of documents in the event things get tight. That's what I'd do if I was him."
"Makes sense," I said. "I keep thinking if Wendell contacted anyone, it'd be his old partner, Carl Eckert."
"Well, it's possible, I guess, but I'm not really sure what kind of reception he'd get. They used to be close, but when Wendell pulled his little vanishing act, Eckert was the one left holding the bag."
"I heard he went to jail."
"Yes, ma'am, he did. Convicted on half a dozen counts of fraud and grand theft. Then the investors went after him in a class action suit, claiming fraud, breach of contract, and who knows what else. Not that it did any good. By then he'd filed for bankruptcy, so there wasn't much to collect."
"How much time did he serve?"
18 months. "But that's not going to stop a sleazy operator like him. Somebody was telling me they ran into him not too long ago. I forget now where it was, but he's still in town. I'll have to see if I can scare him up."
"Shouldn't be that hard," he said. "Meanwhile, what are the chances of you coming by and working with our police artist on a composite? We just hired a kid named Rupert Valbusa. He's a whiz at this stuff."
"Sure, I could do that," I said. Mentally, I was calculating the worrisome issue of Wendell's likeness suddenly being plastered everywhere.
California Fidelity doesn't want him scared off.
"I understand, and believe me, we don't either. I know a lot of people with a vested interest in seeing this guy picked up," Whiteside said. "You have any recent pictures of him?"
"Just some black and white photographs Mac Voorhees provided, but those are 6 and 7 years old. What about you?"
"There's not a mugshot, is there?"
"No, but we had a photograph that went out when Jaffe first disappeared. We can probably adjust that one upward for age."
"What kind of cosmetic work has he had done, could you say?"
"I'd guess chin implant and cheeks. And he's maybe had his nose refined. From the pictures I was given, it looks like his nose used to be broader across the bridge. Also, his hair is snowy white now, and he's bulked up to some extent. Aside from that, he looks pretty fit. Nobody I'd want to tangle with."
"Tell you what, I'll give you Rupert's number, and you two can work out your own arrangements. He doesn't come in on a regular basis, just when we need him to work something out. Soon as he's done, we can issue a be on the lookout.
I can contact Perdido County Sheriff's Department, and in the meantime, I'll call the local FBI offices. They may want to distribute a bulletin of their own."
"I'm assuming there's still an arrest warrant outstanding."
"Yes, ma'am. I ran a check before I picked up the telephone. The feds may want him, too. We'll just have to see what kind of luck we have."
He gave me Rupert Valbusa's telephone number, then added, "The sooner we can get this in circulation, the better."
"Got it. Thanks."
I tried Rupert's number and got his machine. I left him my name, my home telephone number, and a message encompassing the bare bones of the case.
I suggested an early morning meeting, if his schedule permitted, and asked him to get back to me to confirm. I hauled out the telephone book and checked the white pages under record. There were 11 of them listed, along with 2 variations, one Eckhart and one Eckhart, which I didn't think were correct. I tried all 13 numbers, but couldn't stir up a Carl among them. I dialed information in Perdido Olvidado. There was only one Eckhart listed, and that was under the name Francis, whose tone was one of polite caution when I told her I was looking for Carl. "There's no one here by that name," she said. I could feel myself cock an ear, like a dog picking up a signal pitched beyond human hearing. She hadn't said she didn't know him. "Are you related to Carl Eckhart by any chance?" There was a moment of silence. "He's my ex-husband. May I ask what this is about?" "Sure. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator up here in Santa Teresa, and I'm trying to track down some of Wendell Jaffe's old friends."
"Wendell," she said. "I thought he was dead."
"Looks like he's not. In fact, I've been trying to contact old friends and acquaintances on the off chance he might be getting in touch. Is Carl still in the area?"
"Actually, he's up in Santa Teresa, living on a boat."
"Really?" I said. "And you're divorced?"
"You bet. I divorced Carl 4 years ago when he started doing time. I had absolutely no intention of being married to a jailbird."
"I can't say I blame you. I'd have done it if anybody blamed me or not. What a smooth-talking skunk he turned out to be. You find him, you can tell him I said so. There's no love lost between us. Do you happen to have a work number for him?"
"Of course. I give his number to everyone, especially his creditors. It gives me great pleasure."
"Now you'll have to catch him during the day," she went on to caution me. "There's no telephone on the boat, but he's usually there by 6 every evening. Most nights he has supper at the yacht club and then hangs around until midnight."
"What's he look like?"
"Oh, he's very well known. Anyone could point him out. You just go on over there and ask for him by name. You can't miss him."
"What about the name of the boat and the slip number in case he's not at the club?"
She gave me both the marina and the slip numbers.
"The boat's called the Captain Stanley Lord. It was Wendell's," she said.
"Really? How did Carl end up with it?"
"I'll let him tell you that," she said, and hung up.
I did a few odds and ends and then decided to pack it in for the day. I'd felt crummy to begin with, and the antihistamine I'd taken earlier was knocking me for a loop. Since there wasn't much else going on, I thought I might as well go home. I hiked the 2 blocks to my car and headed over to State Street, where I hung a left. My apartment is tucked away on a shady side street just a block off the beach. I found a parking place close by, locked the VW, and let myself in the front gate. The space I now occupy was formerly a single-car garage, converted into a studio, complete with a sleeping loft and a spiral staircase. I have a galley-style kitchen, a living room that serves as guest quarters on occasion, one bathroom down and another one up, all of this fitting together with amazing efficiency. My landlord redesigned the floor plan after an unfortunate explosion 2 Christmases before, and he'd infused the decor with a nautical motif. There was a lot of brass and teak, windows shaped like portholes, built-ins everywhere. The apartment has the feel of an adult-sized playhouse, which is fine with me, as I'm a kid at heart. When I rounded the corner, moving toward the backyard, I saw that Henry's back door was open. I crossed the flagstone patio, linking my studio apartment to the main house on the property. I tapped on the screen, peering into his kitchen, which looked empty.
"Henry? Are you there?"
He must have been in cooking mode. I could smell the sautéed onions and garlic that Henry seems to use as the basis for anything he makes. It was a good indication that his mood had improved. In the months since his brother William moved in, Henry had ceased cooking altogether, in part because William was so finicky about what he ate. In the most self-deprecating manner imaginable, William would declare that a dish had a little bit too much salt for his hypertension, or just that touch of fat he wasn't permitted after his gallbladder removal. Between his fussy bowels and his temperamental stomach, he couldn't handle anything with too much acid or spice. Then there were his allergies, his lactose intolerance, and his heart, his hiatal hernia, his occasional incontinence, and his tendency to pass kidney stones. Henry had taken to making sandwiches for himself, leaving William on his own. William began to take his meals at the neighborhood tavern his beloved Rosie had owned and operated for years. Rosie, while paying lip service to William's maladies, insisted he eat according to her personal gastro-medical dictates. She feels a glass of sherry will remedy any known debilitation. God only knew what her spicy Hungarian cooking had done to his digestive system.
Henry?
Henry said,
Yo,
his voice emanating from the bedroom. I heard footsteps and he came around the corner, his face wreathed in smiles when he caught sight of me.
Well, Kinsey, you're home again. Come on in, I'll be right there.
He disappeared. I let myself into the kitchen. He'd pulled his big soup kettle from the cupboard. There was a bunch of celery in the dish rack, two large cans of crushed tomatoes on the counter, a package of frozen corn, and one of black-eyed peas.
I'm making vegetable soup, he called out. You can join me for supper.
I raised my voice so he could hear me room to room. I'll say yes, but I gotta warn you, you're risking a cold. I came back with a real doozy. What are you doing back there?
Henry reappeared, bringing a stack of fresh hand towels into the kitchen with him.
Folding laundry, he said.
He tucked the towels in a drawer, keeping one out for current use. He stopped and squinted at me.
What's that on your elbow?
I checked the skin on my forearm. The self-tanning lotion had darkened decidedly. My elbow now looked as if it had been swabbed with betadine in preparation for surgery.
That's my tan in a can. You know I hate to sunbathe. It'll wash off in another week.
At least I'm assuming it will.
What's been happening around here? You seem cheerier than I've seen you in months.
Sit down, sit down. You want a cup of tea?
I took a seat on his rocker. This is fine, I said. I'll only stay a minute. I took some medication for my nose and I can barely stand up. I'm thinking to crawl back in bed for the day.
Henry took out a can opener and began to crank open the two tins of crushed tomatoes, which he dumped into the kettle.
You'll never guess what happened. Williams moved in with Rosie.
You mean for good?
I hope. I finally understood that what he did with his life was simply none of my business. I kept thinking I had to save him. It was all so inappropriate. It's a bad match, but so what? Let him discover that for himself. In the meantime, it was making me crazy to have him underfoot. All that talk about sickness and death, depression and palpitations and his diet. My God, let him share that with her. Let them bore each other senseless.
Sounds like the perfect attitude. When did he move out?
Over the weekend. I helped him pack. I even pitched in and moved some of his boxes. It's been heaven ever since.
He flashed me a smile as he picked up the celery and pulled the stalks apart. He rinsed three ribs, then took a knife from the rack and began to dice them.
Go on and hit the sack. You look exhausted. Pop back over here at 6 and I'll feed you some soup.
I may take a rain check, I said. With luck, I'll sleep straight through.
I let myself into my apartment and staggered up to the loft, where I pulled my shoes off and buried myself in my quilt. My phone rang 30 minutes later, and I dragged myself up from the drug-induced depths of sleep. It was Rupert Valbuena. He'd had a brief chat with Lieutenant Whiteside, who'd impressed upon him the importance of getting the composite done. He was going out of town for the next 5 days, but if I was free, he'd be in his studio for another hour. Inwardly I groaned, but I really had no choice. I made a note of the address, which was not far from me in an industrial commercial area just off the beach. A former Beacon's warehouse on Lower Anaconda Street had been converted to a complex of artist studios available for lease. I put my shoes on and did what I could to make myself presentable. I grabbed my car keys, a jacket, and the photographs of Wendell. Outside, the air was damp with the breezes coming off the ocean. As I drove along Cabana Boulevard, I could see patches of pale blue where the cloud cover was breaking up. By late afternoon, we might have an hour of sunshine. I parked on a narrow, tree-lined side street, locked my VW, and walked around the warehouse to the north side, entering the building through a door flanked by two impressive metal sculptures. The interior corridors had been painted stark white, hung with framed works of the artists currently in residence. The ceiling in the hallway rose 3 stories to the roof, where a series of slanted windows admitted broad shafts of daylight. Valbuena was on the top floor. I climbed the 3 flights of metal stairs at the far end of the hallway, my footsteps ringing dully against the painted cinder block walls. When I reached the landing at the top, I could hear the muffled strains of country music. I knocked on Valbuena's door, and the radio was doused. Rupert Valbuena was Hispanic, stocky and muscular.
I put him in his mid-30s, with broad shoulders and a barrel chest. His eyes were dark under the unruly ruffle of his brows. His dark hair was thick, cut full around his face. We introduced ourselves, shaking hands at the door before I followed him in. When he turned to walk away, I could see a narrow braid extending halfway down his back. He wore a white T-shirt, cut-offs, and a pair of tire-soled leather sandals. His legs were nicely shaped, the contours defined by dark, silky hairs. His studio was vast and chilly, with a concrete floor and wide counters circling the perimeter. The air smelled of damp clay, and most surfaces seemed to be coated in the chalky residue of dried porcelain. Big blocks of malleable clay had been swaddled in plastic. He had a kick wheel and a power wheel, two kilns and countless shelves lined with ceramic bowls that had been fired but not yet glazed. At the end of one counter he had a dry copier, an answering machine, and a light box for slides. There were also stacks of dog-eared sketchbooks, jars of drawing pens and pencils, charcoals and watercolor brushes. Three easels had been set up, bearing abstract oil paintings in various stages of completion. "Is there anything you don't do?" "Not all of this is mine. I've taken on a couple of students, though I don't much like to teach. Some of this is their work. You do any art yourself?" "I'm afraid not, but I envy those who do." He moved to the nearest counter, where he picked up a manila envelope with a photograph inside. "Lieutenant Whiteside sent this over for you. Looks like he included an address for the guy's wife." He handed me a slip of paper, which I tucked in my pocket. "Thanks. That's great. It'll save me some time." "This the dude who interests you?" Rupert passed me the picture. I glanced at the grainy 8x11 black-and-white headshot. "That's him. His name is Wendell Jaffe. I've got a few more here just to give you some other views." I pulled out the collection of shots I'd been using for ID purposes and watched as Rupert sorted through them with care, arranging them according to some system of his own.
"Good-looking fellow. What did he do?"
"He and his partner were into real estate development, some of which was legitimate until the bottom dropped. In the end, they ripped off their investors in what's commonly known as a Ponzi scheme, promising big returns when they were really just paying off the old investors with the new investors' money. Jaffe must have realized the end was in sight. He disappeared off his boat in the course of a fishing trip and was never heard from again. Until now, of course. His partner served some jail time, but he's out again."
"This is ringing a bell. I think the Dispatch ran an article about Jaffe a couple of years ago."
"Probably. It's one of those big unsolved mysteries that capture the public imagination. An alleged suicide, but there's been a lot of speculation since." Rupert studied the pictures. I could see his eyes trace the contours of Wendell's face, hairline, the distance between his eyes. He brought the picture up close to his face, angling it toward the window where the light was streaming in.
"How tall?"
"About 6'4". Weight maybe 230. He's in his late 50s, but he's in good shape. I saw him in a bathing suit." I wiggled my eyebrows.
"Not bad."
Rupert moved over to the copier and ran off two copies of the photograph on what looked like rough-textured beige watercolor paper. He dragged a stool over to the window.
"Grab a seat," he said,
nodding toward a cluster of unpainted wooden stools. I hauled one over to the window and perched beside him, watching while he sorted through his drawing pens and pulled four from the jar. He leaned forward and opened a drawer, taking out a box of Prismacolor pencils and a box of pastel chalks. He had an air of distraction, and the questions he began to ask me seemed almost ritualistic, his way of preparing for the task at hand. He secured a copy of the photograph to a board with a clip at the top.
"Let's start at the top. How's his hair these days?"
"White. It used to be medium brown. It's thinner at the temples than in the photograph." Rupert picked up the white pencil and masked out the dark hair. The immediate effect was to make Wendell seem 20 years older and very tanned. I found myself smiling. "Pretty good," I said. "I think he's had his nose trimmed down, here at the bridge and maybe some shaved along here." Where my finger touched the nubby paper, Rupert would shade and contour with fine strokes of chalk or pencil, both of which he wielded with an air of confidence. The nose on the paper became narrow and aristocratic. Rupert began to chat idly while he worked.
"It's always amazed me how many variations can be wrung from the basic components of the human face. Given that most of us come equipped with the standard-issue features—one nose, one mouth, two eyes, two ears— We not only look different from one another, but we can usually identify each other on sight. Do portraits like I do, and you really begin to appreciate the subtleties of the process.
Rupert's unhesitating pencil strokes were adding years and weight, transforming a 6-year-old image to its current-day counterpart. He paused, indicating the eye socket.
What about the fold in here? Has he had his eyes done?
I don't think so.
Droopiness, bags, 5 years would etch in a few lines, I should think.
Maybe some, but not a lot. His cheeks seem more sunken, almost gaunt, I said.
He worked for a moment. How about this?
I studied the drawing.
That's pretty close.
By the time he was finished, I was looking at a reasonable facsimile of the man I'd seen.
I think you got it. He looks good.
I watched as he sprayed the paper with a fixative.
I'll run off a dozen copies and get them over to Lieutenant Whiteside, he said. You want some yourself? I can run you a dozen. That'd be great.
Chapter 7. I had a quick bowl of soup with Henry and then downed half a pot of coffee, managing in the process to offset my lethargy and kick into high gear again. It was time to make contact with some of the principals in the cast. At 7 o'clock, I drove south along the coastline toward Perdido Olvidado. It wouldn't be dark for another hour yet, but the light was fading, the air saturated with an ashen wash of twilight. Billows of fog blowing in from the ocean concealed all but the most obvious aspects of the land. Steep hills, pleated with erosion, rose up on my left, while to the right the heaving gray Pacific was pounding against the shore. The quarter moon was becoming visible in the thick haze of the sky, a pale crescent of light barely discernible in the mist. Along the horizon, the offshore oil platforms lay at anchor like a twinkling armada. The island of St. Michael and two that are known as the Rose and the Cross are threaded like beads along the Cross Islands fault, the entire east-west structural zone undercut by parallel cracks. The Santa Ynez Fault, the North Channel Slope Fault, Pitas Point, Oak Ridge, the San Cayetano, and the San Jacinto Faults branch off like tributaries from the granddaddy of them all, the Great San Andreas Fault, which cuts obliquely across the transverse range. From the air, the San Andreas Fault forms an ominous ridge, running for miles, like the track left by a giant mole tunneling underground. There was a time, long before the earth's folding caused the mountains to buckle upward, when the Perdido Basin was 100 miles long, and much of California was a lowland covered by vast Eocene seas. Back then, this whole region was underwater as far as the Arizona border. The petroleum deposits were actually derived from marine organisms, the sediment in places nearly 13,000 feet thick. There are times when I feel the hairs rising up along my arms at the vision of a world so wildly different from ours. I imagine the changes, millions of years speeded up like time-lapse photography, in which the land heaves and snaps, thrusting, plunging, and shifting in a thunderous convulsion. I glanced out at the horizon. 24 of the 32 platforms along the California coast are near Santa Teresa and Perdido counties, 9 of them within 3 miles of shore. I'd heard the dispute about whether those old platforms could withstand a big 7.0 magnitude trembler. The experts were divided. On one side of the debate were the geologists and representatives of the State Seismic Safety Commission, who kept pointing out that the oldest offshore oil platforms were built between 1958 and 1969, before the petroleum industry adopted uniform design codes. Reassuring us of our comfort and security were spokesmen for the oil companies who owned the rigs. Gosh, it was baffling. I tried to picture the effect. All those rigs collapsing, oil spewing into the ocean in a gathering storm of black. I thought about the current contamination of beaches, raw sewage spilling into oceans and streams, the hole in the ozone, forests being stripped, the toxic waste dumps, the merry plunder of mankind added to the drought and the famine that nature dishes up annually as a matter of course. It's hard to know what's actually going to get us first. Sometimes I think we should just blow the whole planet and get it over with. It's the suspense that's killing me. I passed a stretch of state beach and rounded the point, sliding into the town of Perdido from its westernmost edge. I took the first Perdido off-ramp, cruising through the downtown business district while I got my bearings. The wide main street was edged with diagonal head-in parking. Lots of pickup trucks and recreational vehicles in evidence. A convertible proceeded slowly down the street behind me with its car radio booming. The combination of brass instruments and thunderous bass reminded me of the thumping passage of a 4th of July parade. The windows on every other business seemed to be decked with handsome canvas awnings, and I wondered if the mayor had a brother-in-law in the business. The housing tract where Dana Jaffe now lived was probably developed in the 70s when Perdido enjoyed a brief real estate boom. The house itself was a story and a half, charcoal gray stucco with white wood trim. Most of the homes in the neighborhood had 3 and 4 vehicles parked in the driveways, suggesting a population more dense than the single-family residential zoning implied. I pulled into the drive behind a late-model Honda. Twilight was deepening. Zinnias and marigolds had been planted in clusters along the walk. In the dim illumination from an ornamental fixture, I could see that the shrubs had been neatly trimmed, the grass mowed, and some effort made to distinguish the house from its mirror-image neighbors. Trellising had been added along the fence line. The honeysuckle vines trained up the latticework lent at least the illusion of privacy, perfuming the air with incredible sweetness. Bell, I extracted a business card from the depths of my handbag. The front porch was stacked high with moving cartons, all packed and sealed. I wondered where she was headed. After a pause, Dana Jaffe answered the door with a telephone receiver tucked in the crook of her neck. She toted the instrument across the room, trailing 25 feet of cord. She was the kind of woman I've always found intimidating, with her honey-colored hair, her smoothly sculpted cheekbones, her gaze cool and level. She had a straight, narrow nose, a strong chin, and a slight overbite. A glint of very white teeth peeped out from full lips that at rest wouldn't quite close. She put the face of the receiver against her chest, muffling our conversation for the person on the other end. Yes? I held out my card so she could read my name. I'd like to talk to you. She glanced at the card with a little frown of puzzlement before she handed it back. She held up an index finger, making an apologetic face as she gestured me in. I crossed the threshold and stepped into the living room just ahead of her, my gaze following the path of the telephone cord